You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radical Australia on Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast by the great producer Daryl, 1R, D-A-R-Y-L. My name's Joseph Toscano. Now, Daryl, how's your little show going?
Oh, it's going really good, Joe.
Listenership has increased since you've become a producer here on Radical Australia, do you think?
I've got no idea. I had a great interview with the last show, though, with the new Secretary of the Australian Unemployed Workers Union.
I assume that's a voluntary position.
Yep.
I don't expect they get paid.
No, none of us do. No.
So what's the show again and what time is it on?
It's on Mondays at 6 o'clock. And
6 p.m., I assume.
6 p.m., yeah. It's where we let all the people getting unemployment benefits sickness benefits, what their rights are.
Yeah, I shouldn't have asked you whether it was 6 p.m. because it wouldn't be 6 a.m. because you're not wage slaves. You don't have to get up to the clock.
Plus, we're unemployed.
So. You don't have to get up to the clock. You're very lucky.
Yeah.
Now, our guest is a Mr. Peter Stevenson, Stevenson. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Joe. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, you can thank me now. You may not at the end of the chat. I mean, Daryl's doing all the hard work there. Without him, we're two show ponies. He does all the work and we get the credit.
Thanks, Daryl.
Yeah. We're thanking you now. But the trouble is, if we are a bit too rude, he just walks out. Nobody can hear us, so we've got to be kind to him. Have you ever thought of walking out, Daryl?
Not yet.
Excellent. Okay.
But I know the show would stop dead without me, so.
That's why he's the producer. He's the only one with any ethics or morals, apart from you, Peter. Now, Peter, what year were you born?
1958.
And where were you born?
Wentworthville in New South Wales.
Where?
Wentworthville, near Parramatta, two stations west of Parramatta.
That sounds interesting. That's one of the early places that was colonised, wasn't it?
Parramatta Park. Maury's house there. Yeah.
All there. Yeah. Your parents, are they local or?
Both passed now. They retired out of Sydney up to Nelson Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And my sisters were up there. Yeah, once I lost one sister to breast cancer, unfortunately.
Right. What was her name?
Kay.
And what was she like?
She was the best of us. They always take the best, don't they?
How many of you were there?
I've got one middle sister.
Yep.
Laurie and myself, yep.
Right. And how old was she when she died?
Kay, the youngest, she was 50.
50. Yeah. And was it one of those long struggles? Or?
It was a fairly aggressive cancer. Mm. Yeah. So it was. We had a great family trip to Fiji before she passed. That was really special for us all to remember.
Right. And what were your parents' name?
So Margaret Helen.
Mm-hmm.
Nee Armitage.
Yep.
Scottish mother, English father. And my father was Keith Hall Stevenson.
Right.
Hall was a nod to George Hall, who was the colonial royalty of the Hawkesbury, from the Coromandel families. Seven families settled together.
Well, how about the Scots? Were they royalty? You got tickets on yourself there, mate.
No. They were from the Coromandel. The Halls were from Northumberland, so they were
all right.
Borders.
Okay, yeah, yeah. All right, we'll talk about.
They were impacted by the Scottish Enlightenment. They had very good education, but they couldn't buy their own land, or the English were forcing them to practice their religion way. So that was the incentive to come out.
So were the Anglo-Irish. They weren't Anglo-Irish then.
No.
No. Right. Okay. All right. Where'd you go to primary school?
Westmead, which is the one more station closer to Parramatta.
Right. And what was that like?
It was a great little school. Yeah. Yeah. No, it was. Wasn't the biggest school in the area, but it was. Still got. Close friends that we went to primary school.
Really?
Which is pretty amazing.
You meet often or occasionally?
Every 10 years we have a reunion. Right. 50th is next year.
Yep.
That's actually from our final year at high school. We went to Graystanes High School.
Right. Graystanes.
Graystanes.
Oh, Graystanes.
Right.
I thought he moved to the USA.
Yeah.
What was school like for a little lad?
Yeah, like we lived a pretty privileged life back then, mm-hmm. I think. Didn't have too many worries. Had good holidays, had good job opportunities.
No, I'm talking about primary school.
Oh, primary school? Yeah, primary school, the biggest thing for me, I've got a bit of a competitive streak.
All right.
In grade six, our teacher put a little postcard painting, three of them, on the front of the classroom and put them up on the top of the desk and said whoever comes first in the class can have first choice of those.
Mm.
So I got first in the class for the first time and only time in my life.
Right.
And I also got the most cuts of the cane, which is probably saying something.
Was it the cane or the strap?
No, it was cane back then. Yeah.
On the back of the legs or the hands?
No, that was on the hand. Miss Jacobs in grade five gave it across the knees. That was far worse.
Yeah. So corporal punishment was part and parcel of our experiences in primary school. Well, did you learn anything in primary school? Did you find something you liked?
Primary school, used to do mental arithmetic each morning.
Mental?
Yeah, so they were questions that were read out and answered mentally, not written down.
Mm-hmm.
I used to really like that. I still like puzzles now.
Right.
Still like Sudoku and Kenkin and those sort of things. We had a couple of drawers in the class, so we used to have a bit of a competition on drawing.
Mm.
I ended up becoming a draftsman in the end, so I think that's what I planned to see.
So which postcard did you choose?
Out of the paintings?
Yeah, which painting did you choose? Yeah.
They were all the same theme. They were all pretty simple. They were sunset.
Right.
Orange and red,
and
yellow
.
With a black silhouette of islander theme with a palm tree. But just the one I thought was the best. That was
You still got it?
Yeah.
Where does it sit?
Packed away in boxes now.
In boxes?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We'll find out why later on.
No.
It's in boxes.
Yeah, my wife's a declutterer. I'm a hoarder. Got something to do with it.
Yeah, and so where did you go to high school?
So Greystanes High School. Yeah.
Right. So that was a public school?
Yeah. Parramatta was the closest, and a lot of my primary school friends went to Parramatta. But Greystanes was a much bigger school, 1,200 population, good facilities, good teachers.
Yeah, you're quite happy there.
Yeah, we still talk about the teachers we had. Yeah, great
teachers. So tell us about the teachers, because obviously they have an influence.
Yeah, absolutely. We had, through the junior high school years, they just were steady, They gave us opportunities to express ourselves. That was all good. But the biggest ones, obviously, was year 11 and year 12. Or year 10 started to get a real influence on it. So our industrial arts woodwork tech drawing teacher was our career guidance counsellor. So we just used to go and see Mr. Root for a chat.
Yeah.
It was like a relationship we had with him,
more than
career guidance. So it was just, he was really good for us. The group of mates I had that were into cars and bikes and engineering.
Mm.
Yeah, but we had a great English teacher. So I was good at writing. I was good at essays. Not a theorist with language, but I was good at writing essays, telling stories.
Mm. So this was obviously New South Wales. Now, I'm not sure what happens at the end of year 12 in New South Wales. What do you get?
You get a HSC.
HSC.
Yeah, I was the first year of units rather than levels in
year
11.
What does that mean?
You used to have first level, second level, I think. Whatever. Yep. I didn't do it, so I can't remember
the
language.
Yeah.
But then we had units in year 11. We're the first year of units. So you had to do 10, but you could fit in 12. Our school made us do 12.
Right.
But some people maximise their mark by doing lower units. Where I love maths, so I did a 3-unit maths subject.
Right.
And the others, and I had one unit left, or 2 units was a normal level.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did physics and industrial arts and English.
I'm interested in this subject, industrial arts.
Mm.
I mean,
engineering science, they changed it to.
I'm about, 7 or 8 years older than you.
Yep.
And we just had metalwork and woodwork.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's up to year 10.
Right.
Year 11 and 12 is.
So what is industrial arts?
So you start to do a little bit of mechanics and a little bit of material science.
Mm.
And so in woodwork and metalwork, you do it, it's more example.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've still got my little dustpan that have tin dust stand I gave Mum, and it means a lot to me because Mum used to use it.
Yeah,
so,
that's when I realised that I had no technical abilities, and if I had to go forward, I had to kind of look at the intellectual things because I used to come home with bruises from the hammer. It was pathetic.
My dad was a carpet layer, and I used to help him in my teenage years. And I knew very quickly I wasn't going to be a carpet layer because it was too hard work.
Oh, it is very hard work, especially on the back. Yeah. So you haven't mentioned the S word, which everybody talks about at high school, sport.
Sport, No, sport was a big part. I had a good bunch of mates that I played soccer with.
Mm-hmm. That's unusual for that period.
I played rugby league. It was weight for age in primary school.
Right. And what position did you play?
I played prop forward.
Oh, very good. Yeah. You must have had a bit of beef on you.
Well, I had a bit of height.
Height.
Weight for age. You haven't got a lot of beef.
No.
Weight for age. I think it was 5'6" from memory.
Right.
Whatever that is in the modern school.
Yeah.
And then high school, of course, and it's open.
That's right.
I only lasted two games. I got out of there very quickly. I didn't have a thick neck, so it wasn't much fun.
Very cruel.
Yeah, so I started playing soccer when I was 12.
12.
Yeah.
There are a lot of kids from England and Europe at the school
soccer, right? Yeah, we had a mix. We used to, like, the big lunchtime sport was touch football. Rugby league was everything. And, like, Parramatta supporter. Rugby league with you. I was a big tennis player. Tennis was probably it was the main sport for me as well. Mm-hmm. So I had that change out.
Were you going to be the next big thing? Or?
I didn't have anybody to really guide me after because juniors finished at 16. So I actually didn't play tennis from 16 to 19, which is probably the most important years.
Right.
But it meant that I'm still playing it because I'm still keen.
Right, because, they didn't have talent scouts in those days because,
Yeah, that's what my soccer coach used to say. You reckon if they had talent scouts, I would have been picked up and I'd be somewhere else. But I've got a good bunch of mates, good bunch of friends.
So do you have a high school reunion? Is what, like the primary school reunion?
Yeah. Well, no, we don't have the primary school reunion, sorry. No. I meant the high school. But one of the guys I went to primary school with, because not many of us went to Grey Staines from Westmead, he's probably one of the organisers of the school reunion. They're just talking about next year's now.
Yeah, we only had one at our school. For the 25th anniversary, and we've never had one since.
Right.
You know, kind of the embarrassing questions like, what's John doing? Oh, he's in Bogger Road jail for rape. and then they say, what's Edward doing? Oh, he's in jail for murder. So it wasn't a pleasant experience, the 25th reunion. Yeah. Well, it was like that, you know.
Yeah. Well, the 10th year one was just like a backyard pool party.
Yeah.
And I was just courting my wife at the time, and she pushed the host into the pool.
Oh, right.
It's pretty amazing. And I also remember one of the friends was the first to have a baby.
Right.
It must have been like a two-year-old just starting to walk.
Yeah.
Emily's child fell into the pool.
Ooh.
And I remember, like, everyone was in shock and no one moved. And the baby was under the water, and it was like the baby was in a fantasy land. She was looking at the lights and everything. It wasn't panicked at all.
No.
It was just like, oh, this is a new environment.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden someone woke up and they dove in and got it. Those two things stacked my mind.
Well, so was this at your place, the park?
No. One of the guys that we were in school with. Yeah. Phil's place.
So you finish high school. What happens then?
I got a traineeship at Garden Island Dockyard.
Right, yep. Everybody knows Garden.
Yeah.
There was Evans Deacon in Brisbane, Garden Vale in Sydney.
Yeah,
there's
Dockyard in every
Williamstown,
capital city.
Williamstown
Dockyard here. So Garden Island, Williamstown were the same, except Williamstown used to build ships. Garden Island didn't actually ever build ships, but they had the southern, the Captain Cook Dock, which is the biggest graving dock in the southern hemisphere. So that's why Garden Island's still there and not in Jarvis Bay, for example.
Right.
Still in the best bit of real estate in Sydney.
Did you learn a little bit of the history of Garden Island? It wasn't very pleasant in the early days.
Yeah, no, it was an island, and then the graving dock actually bridged the gap in between, so they didn't have to dig such a deep hole, it was already there.
Yeah,
and it's built
during the convict era, it wasn't a nice place.
Yeah, well, the docks at like Cockatoo Island, and I did about 6 months of Cockatoo Island, that's a hand cut out of sandstone graving dock, same as the Williamstown one here, hand-laid, cut out and then hand-laid in sandstone.
A lot of work.
Yeah.
So what did your traineeship entail?
Sorry?
You said you did a traineeship.
Oh, yeah, traineeship. Yeah.
What did that entail?
Yeah, so in those days, we were just at the changeover of you used to leave in year 10, do a trade, and then if you're good at your trade, then go up the drawing office, and then if you're good at the drawing office, then go and do engineering. That was the right. full route in the old days.
Yeah.
I was at the transition where we went to year 12 because jobs were starting to get more competitive, so you needed a year 12 standard of education for the competition. And but you were missing out on the trade. So Garden Island had bought the old Qantas Apprentice Training School at Zetland. And so the apprentices, instead of going with the leading hand like in the old days, the first-year apprentices went out to the training school and they did their whole list of example more advanced as they went on through the year. Mm-hmm. And then they'd go out and do the trade back at the dockyard. So we, as trainee draftsmen, we didn't have trade. So they put us 3 months with the for naval architecture, which was the traineeship I did. So it's like an architect for a house, but except it's for a ship.
Right.
They put us 3 months with the shipwrights, which were the measure uppers and the timber work, 3 months with the boilermakers, which is all the steel work, and 3 months with the fitter and turners, so that we knew enough that we could not design something that was impossible to make.
Like,
we had some practical skills,
right.
And so we knew what we were drawing.
What type of thing were the old boilermakers and, you know, all the workers thinking when you mob turned up? Did they give you a hard time?
No, but of course it was like a school, right? So it wasn't the they weren't the hard-nosed tradesmen. They were instructors.
Instructors, right.
And so they were quite good, and they didn't knock us around. But once you got on the job,
right,
and you design something and you got to go down the ship because there's some problem with it,
right,
and then the big boilermaker who's standing over you saying, what the hell's going on?
Right.
You start to realise the pressure of holding production up. And I was fortunate to get on the Anzac Ship Project, which was one of our really successful before they took shipbuilding out of Victoria.
Right.
And in South Australia and Western Australia styled it all.
Right.
Working at Williamstown Dockyard was on the Anzac Ship Project.
So how long were you at Williamstown for?
We moved here in 93.
What? You said we. Who's we?
Oh, the family. Yeah.
How many?
We had two kids. They were 3 and 1 when we arrived. Yep. Alex and Prue.
And your wife?
And wife, yeah, Donna.
Right.
And, yep. And so she did, she was a legal secretary at that stage, but then she went in because she had paralegal experience. She went in as a secretary at the shipyard, but they saw the paralegal, so she became a commercial buyer at the shipyard.
Right.
So she had 7 years at the shipyard in the end. We used to work, because of the hours, she was able to work 6:30 to 3:30, and then I'd work 9:30 to 6:30, and we had the kids in our own,
Can I tell you a true story about the shipyards?
Uh-huh.
Long before you arrived.
Yes.
Oh, no, it's somebody who's now dead, and he turned up here as a refugee in the 50s, right? A 16 or 17-year-old kid.
Yep.
And he gets a job at the Williamstown Shipyard, because I knew this bloke personally. And he said the first day he went down, he had hardly any English, and he was the lad. So I'll try not to swear, but at lunchtime they said to him, go down to the bakery down the road and tell me you want 6 effing pies, right? Right, true story. That's what it was like. So he goes down there and there's this poor 16-year-old girl, 15, 16-year-old girl, the daughter of the baker, you know, and he says, we need, you know, 6 effing pies, you know? And he said, and the bloke comes out from the back of the bakery and says, what did you just say to my daughter? And he said, oh, 6 effing pies. That's all he knew in English, right? So they called the police, right? And they took him away to the watch house down at Williamstown. And the blokes on the job said, what's happened to the lazy bastard? He hasn't brought back our pies. So they went down to the bakery, found out what happened, went to the watch house and got him out. And that was his first day's experience at Williamstown Dockyards. That's what the hazing was like in those days. Yeah. True story.
That reminds me of an Ananu story from Uluru, actually.
All right.
I've read the book Ananu.
So no, tell us about
Ananu
it.
Ananu people.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell a little story in there about squatters were using the Aboriginals as workers out on the runs.
Yeah.
And they asked this one Aboriginal fellow to go back and get see his wife and get my effing knife.
Right.
And so on the way back to the camp, he found a goanna and he got that for food for the family and he got all these waylays. So, and it's not his language, right? So he got it all maxed up.
Yeah.
And he said, boss man, tell him he come and effing wife. And so, they ended up like, and they shot him. So,
So that's the way it goes. That's the way they didn't shoot this bloke. They just laughed at him. So how long did it take to finish the traineeship?
So there are 4-year traineeships. Yeah.
And what happens after that?
And then you become a qualified draftsman, so public service. Right. So I was a civilian.
This is in New South Wales.
This is New South Wales, yep.
Yep. And then you become what?
A grade 1 draftsman.
Right.
Yep. Then grade 2, then senior supervising, that's the structure.
Yeah.
And then there's one chief.
Right.
Only one chief.
Yeah.
So there's a set structure. Yep.
Did your wife forgive you for coming to... Melbourne, you know, I mean, leaving her family and everybody.
Yeah, well, we both, so I ended up in Navy Office in Canberra after 9 years in Sydney. And too long a story to tell you how I got there. But anyway, she's from Griffin the Riverina, so a lot of Riverina people go to Canberra for work.
Yep.
When you get a government person, you get put up in a hostel for free for 3 months if you haven't got any family or anything. Yep. So. Then from that network of people you met a lot of Riverina people, went out into share houses. So through that Riverina network, that's how I met my wife. And then we got to a point where I only had one more step to go almost in that structure I described in Navy Office in Canberra. So and then this opportunity came up with mates that had joined this company already. And, so we end up competing for the Anzac ship and won it. And... So we went overseas for 2.5 years with that.
Hang on, you went overseas. Why did you go overseas?
So it was a German syndicate that won the Anzac ship project, the Mika 200 design. So Blohm & Voss, they built the Bismarck, so don't mention the war sort of thing.
Yep.
And that was a great opportunity to work there for 2.5 years.
Where in Germany?
Hamburg.
Hamburg. Yep. Where else?
Yep.
Where else? Shouldn't have asked that, should I? No. Should have known, did you?
Interesting place, because like we had the, says minus 20 for 2 weeks and the Elbe becomes a big slush puppy, all the banks freeze, so you can't go across on the ferry anymore.
Right.
And you've got to go, they've got a vertical car lift and a tunnel underneath. Apparently when they were blowing up the shipyard after the war, they were cracking that tunnel and they didn't want to damage the total infrastructure of the city, so they stopped and... So Blohm & Voss were able to get up and running fairly quickly again after the war, and did commercial stuff first. But then
What exactly did it? What did you do for 2.5 years?
The idea was that we were giving the German departments guidance on the Anzac design,
right?
Because it was based on a ship performance spec, so we were giving them guidance on the ship performance.
So what, Australians had designed the ship?
Yeah. So it was a German design. So basically the different consortiums had to find an existing ship that best suited this ship performance spec and then modify it, see how they were going to modify it to suit that. So we were giving the departments guidance. We're actually working in the departments. The shipyard, which was Amicon, Transfield, ended up being Tenex, and now it's BAE.
Yep.
Now it's a ghost town.
Right, yes.
But BAE is still in Melbourne, but they're up in the city. I've lost my train now. Where are we at?
You're in Germany, and I asked why, what were you doing there?
Yeah. So that's right. So the shipyard reopened up all the contracts. So to more competitive bidding.
Yep.
So that extended our stay for 10 months. So we got to work on other... So I got to work on the Hellenic ship, got to do sea trials on the Portuguese Mika 200, which was what supposedly the Australian was based on, but the Greek one was actually closer, had the same helicopter, and got to work on the F-123, which is the German frigate at the time. So it was a really good experience,
So this is, you were married then, weren't you?
Yeah, our son was born in Hamburg.
Right.
Yeah, we had to get him nationalised as 2 Australian parents.
That's right.
Before we could get him a passport.
That's right. Because we don't accept anymore that the children of Australians are Australians.
Mm.
Interesting,
right.
Isn't it?
Yeah, Germany's they don't have the dual nationality thing.
That's right. Because maybe they would have let you in and told him to go home, put him in a crib and send him back, I reckon. It looks like that.
Im iron hamburger, so he'll always be a hamburger.
He'll be a hamburger.
He's got a Hamburg Singular Krankenhaus birth certificate.
All right, yeah, well, that's it. Yeah, well, don't make too much of it because he may not be able to stand for Parliament because of Section 44 of the Australian Constitution. He may be entitled to a German citizenship.
No, he's not.
You're sure?
Yep.
You never know. If he's ever elected, some little scumbag will bring it up. You watch. The only good thing is it has to go to the High Court to be decided. All right, this sounds all pretty idyllic and nice, you know. You're building a family. You've got a good wife. She's working. You're working. You're in one of the great cities of the world. You're doing something productive. How long did all that last for?
Till last July.
Last July.
Yeah, I retired last July, yeah.
What, were you forced to retire or you just thought the time had come?
No, it was, my daughter's an artist and I had started helping her with admin on that art practice.
Right.
And so I did.
So what's her art practice?
Visual arts.
Right.
Yep. And it's, I get trouble for name dropping sometimes.
Not on this. We need names to be dropped, don't we, Darryl?
Well, I've covered myself there with that statement.
Yeah, we sure do.
We sure do. We need it. So keep going.
Yeah, so you can look up Prue Stevenson.
PrueStevenson.com.
Stevenson.
But what does she do?
She's an autistic woman.
Right.
And her art practice, a lot of it's about showing the invisible side of autism in a visual sense. Yeah, so she's got...
So how difficult was it for her as she grew up? You know, did it take a while to realise?
Autism isn't the problem. Society's the problem.
Right. Explain that to me.
It's like all things in society, point of difference, I suppose. Mm. And she's the best person in the room on most things.
Right.
When she's got full capacity.
Yep.
But when she's not at full capacity, then society's very ableist. So they,
very judgmental.
Judgmental on difference. That's it. But in the right environment.
So how hard was it bringing her up for you? I don't want to dwell on it. I'm just, think it's easy. It's not, is it?
It's not. No. And you're battling against society at every step of the way. So I'd build relationships and my wife, Donna, we'd build relationships at each institution on the way through.
Mm.
The conundrum is that she got basically dropped out of school at year 10 and maybe didn't get expelled, but it got difficult enough to move schools about four times before that. Yep. But then she's got a bachelor in fine arts at RMIT and then done a master's by practice and she got student of the year in a final master's. So that's the conundrum of, if you get people in the right environment, they excel.
That's Look,
there's two things. The disability community, that's probably why I'm an advocate because I've been an advocate in that space.
Right.
But they've taught, the disability community, they've taught me, one is that universal design, like you can't get the right solutions unless you've got all the voices at the table. And the example I use for universal design, like texting, was made for deaf people to be able to talk.
Right.
And so, but then we all use it. There's, that's the argument for having all the voices at the table and a good cross-section of society.
Right. That's the first point. What's the second point? You said
it was that universal design and all the voices at the table.
Voices at the table.
Yeah, yep.
Oh, excellent. And so how much time have you put into in that sector?
I probably spent in the arts sector probably 6 years.
6 years.
And then Prue's got to a stage now where she wanted to, become fully independent, which she's there now.
That's excellent.
Where we're going to go next was my family history story.
No. I asked the questions.
Yeah. I only assumed.
He's waiting. We're going to areas he doesn't want us to go into. But look, have a sip of water.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
And I'll do a station announcement, all right? Peter, just relax. We'll get there, won't we, Daryl? We always get there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, this is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. We're chatting to Peter Stevenson. This program is podcast. The world's second greatest producer, Daryl. You're not the greatest yet.
Who's the first?
The person up in the sky. You can never compete with that one, all right? The iCloud. Yeah. Oh, the cloud. That's the greatest producer. You're second. And, so the program is podcast. We've got hundreds of chats there, interviews, whatever you like to call them. And at the end of the program, Daryl takes some photographs. We've got some beautiful new 3CR Radiophon posters. So let's not forget, Daryl, that we've got Radiophon on the 11th.
11th of June. Yeah, that's right.
Between 4 and 5, and we don't do prizes. We don't give out anything. We just give people big hearts. We make them feel good as when they give us money. So get your money ready for the Radiophon on the 11th.
We say their name on air, though, don't we?
Well, if they want to. Some people don't want to be associated with us. They give us money to go away.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, so good. All right, Peter, I know you're chafing at the bit like a Clydesdale, you know, like Daryl there, and you want us to get onto the real story, but you did have a life before you retired, and that's what we wanted to look at.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, yep.
So you're retired, you're looking at the void, there's nothing to do. What happened?
At 60, I suppose, I transitioned down to 4 days a week.
Transitioned, I like that.
Because the art practice admin was, I wanted some life balance.
Uh-huh.
And then we went to 3 days a week.
Who's that we? You, Id, alter ego, the whole works.
Yeah, the whole works, yeah. Right. Well, I had to get negotiated with the business.
Right.
And,
so you're still an employee? Or you?
Yeah, and I went off the front line a little bit more, and we implemented a cloud system for our ERP, so I got involved in that.
Mm.
So that was lucky because when COVID came, we were all in the cloud, finance and projects, timekeeping and everything. So that was filling our backsides there a little bit.
Well, you would agree with me. Daryl could never compete with the cloud, could he? No way. No way could you, Daryl.
I don't know a lot about it. So
I don't think we compete with the cloud, do we? We just store stuff in the cloud.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, you know,
we still need human intervention to actually create things.
That's what you think. We'll see what happens in the future.
Yeah.
All right. So and then what? You're fully retired.
And then come the Nationals announcing the no policy in November 22 for the referendum.
Mm.
I just thought, I've got this family history background.
Right.
I know the family's been on the frontier. I don't know the details of it. I thought the no policy, we were supposed to have a national conversation. Just having a straight no policy was just sound unfair.
So were you in Melbourne then, or you'd gone back?
Yeah. We've been in Melbourne since 93. So I just started pulling a couple of things together then.
Mm.
And then as I started finding out more and more, and then I also had 10 years in the public service, so my super matured at 65.
Oh, right.
So I had to take that part pension anyway.
Yeah, it's a pity. It's a pity you weren't around when the retirement age for federal public servants was 55.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I had a few friends who took advantage of it.
I think we're all looking after our health, or hopefully touch wood.
Right. But, okay.
So it seemed to be the right year for me.
So what year was this?
So last year. I was 65 and a bit. I turned 66 last September.
Yeah.
Retired in July. So it was a big year last year because we our first grandson was born in February.
Mm-hmm.
The Anzac ship, the first of class, paid out after 28 years in, I think it was March.
Right.
I retired in July, and then we sold the business in November.
Right.
Because we'd had a management buyout 8 years prior. So it it all felt the right time. And then I also, I'd been referred to a postgrad subject at RMIT, which was working in first people's contexts, production and design.
So why did you go into that direction? I mean, there's a lot of things you could have gone into. Why that direction?
Well, our family history story, there's not very many. I've termed myself a colonial truth teller now.
A colonial truth teller.
Yeah.
Well, that's a first.
Well, there's a few of us out there.
Right, but
David
Marr
comes to mind with Killing for Country.
Yeah, but it's an interesting term, isn't it?
It is, yeah, because there's not a lot of us around.
So we're not talking about the colonised, we're talking about the colonisers.
Yes.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about your family background. I mean, you've kind of, I may know a little bit, but listeners don't, Darryl doesn't.
No. So my grandmother was born in Oberon and came down and lived in Wentworthville. Dad bought the house next door, so I grew up next to Grandma, and Dad inherited the signage on the front of Grandma's house, which was Bungool. And I've inherited that now, and I've placed it on our house in Willie. And
Bungool, what does it
Bungool
mean?
Bungool, so it means in Dargling language, echoing cliffs. So echoing the sandstone cliffs of the Hawkesbury.
Right.
So it was the original land grant. It wasn't the first grant. So George Hall, who's my fourth-gen great-grandfather, he came out in the Coromandel. He actually organised a Coromandel trip, seven families from the Scottish borders, from Northumberland. And
What year are we talking about?
1801 they came out.
1801. Yep. So some of the first three immigrants, basically.
And and there were seven families with seven different trades, so they all settled together and created an independent community.
So how far from Sydney did they settle?
So first land was given to them at Toongabby.
Right, yeah.
Middle western suburbs, terrible land. I asked for another allocation so that the Hawkesbury was getting more mature by then, and they got given land around Portland Head, Cat Eye on Little Cat Eye Creek, mm-hmm. Bungool is. It's now Riverside Oaks Golf Course, the home of the Australian PGA.
Right.
Yep.
So that was what, farming?
Farming. And,
Were they farming or were they graziers?
Well, cropping first off.
Cropping, right.
And then they would have actually gone to sheep and then eventually into cattle,
So they actually got grants, so they weren't actual squatters who went outside.
No, those ones were grants.
Right.
And then I think the Hutter started getting squatted,
mm-hmm.
but the legend goes that one of George's sons, John, who was, I think he was born, John was born on the ship on the way across. I can't remember that exactly. Mm. But he was the first one to find the way over the sandstone country of the Bulga,
right.
Which is from basically Wiseman's Ferry, McDonald River, Wallumbye, through over to the southern escarpment of the Hunter Valley,
right.
That sandstone country there. So I grew up going to the northern coast of New South Wales for holidays, and you'd go through from Hornsby to past to Newcastle and it'd just be nothing, you know, because it was just all sandstone country. It wasn't good for farming or anything like that.
No.
But there was a whole culture in there that got knocked out very quickly because it was a fairly fragile culture.
So you're talking about a culture. What are you talking about?
So the First Nations culture.
Which particular group?
So Dargunung were the people in that area. Yeah.
Right.
So I'll go back to the mates I still got with soccer, right?
Right.
I had a 2018, we had a golf reunion at Blackheath.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the information centre because I used to go up there with Boys Brigade from Wendy. We'd catch the train up to Blackheath, walk down into the Grose Valley, do it for a weekend.
Right
from when I was sort of 12, 13, 14.
Mm.
And so I took these soccer mates who weren't in Boys Brigade along to show them where these walks were. Went to the information centre and I just, you know, things in life, you just gravitate to something sometimes.
Yep.
And there was this book called Bulga Bala Boree and I pulled it out. And it was all about the sandstone country, and I knew our family had the first grant at Cat Eye. And so I opened it up, and there's a section in the back called The Great Australian Silence.
Right.
By the author Gil Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm personal friends with Gil now. I've stayed at his bush block up in the sandstone country, up at the top end of near St Albans, past St Albans.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bulga Bala Boree. Bulga's the sandstone country. Boree's the Boree Trail, which is the Aboriginal trail through the sandstone country to this large corroboree site at the top of Mogo Creek. So it's just above St Albans. And
let's get this right. St Albans, New South Wales.
South Wales.
Not down near Keel here.
No. Yeah, so anyway, as I started to piece this family history story together, I thought, there's not a lot of people doing this sort of stuff. It needs to be told.
Right.
We got the Uluru Statement is Truth Treaty voice. they were being part of the Europe. Let's
get back to your family.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
So the reason I retired...
You know everything.
I timed my retirement around the date of the start of that, the RMIT postgrad on working in First Peoples context because I wanted to
why,
do this.
Why?
Because I wanted to do it culturally correctly. I didn't want to just do harm with the story. I wanted to...
But you're looking at your family history. You're not actually looking...
Yeah.
So what's it got to do with the story, your family history? What's it got to do... I mean...
Well,
I can look at my family history.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Okay. So,
tell me.
So, after George held back on the squatting a little bit, but once they found the path over the Volga, they end up going up exploring the country. They had very good eye for land with water, with droving for it. So, they end up creating an estate by 1844 all the way to Boulogne River in the Darling Downs around Surat.
In the Darling Downs in Queensland.
Yeah. So there, but the whole boast was they could drove cattle from the Darling Downs to the Sydney markets and sleep on their own land every night. It's in a massive state. I'll show you the map. The map's in my Europe Justice Commission.
Yeah. All right. No, hang on. So give us an idea of how big this land that was squatted. What are we talking about? Kilometres?
I'm not very good on land sizes, but they had...
you're talking about hundreds of kilometres. I know the Darling Downs intimately.
Last 2 years, I've driven from the Bungool to Mile Creek, which is the massacre that everybody... Well, it's the most well-known massacre because it was women, children and elders only, not men.
Mm.
The humanitarian considerations were getting pushed a lot more from the UK. So they're the first men that got charged and then eventually hung for killing Aboriginals.
Mm.
And the free settler leader of that was John Henry Fleming. He's my fourth generation grandfather, George Hall's nephew.
I'm a bit confused.
Okay.
When it comes to four generations, right?
Yes.
You're the Halls.
Yes.
You're descendant from the Halls.
Yep. Yep.
So how does, our good friend, John Henry Fleming, a respected member of society, school children honour guard at, on his death in, 1884 or something, this is the leader of the Mile Creek Massacre, the only one who escaped prosecution.
Yep.
Fill the dots for me.
Well, there's a whole lead up to Mile Creek.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, and there's Major Nunn.
There's Major Nunn with Waterloo Creek. There's Gravesend, Slaughterhouse Creek.
Yeah, there's all that. But your family, how's it interconnected?
Well, it was the whole family on the frontier. George's, all his sons were on the frontier. And from my reading, the one who was most like George and the one that's the most written about is Thomas Simpson Hall. Mm-hmm. So Thomas Simpson's the seventh son, but he was born in the Hawkesbury. He would have learned how to swim in the Hawkesbury River with the Aboriginal kids there.
Yeah.
But he became a very good cattle breeder, but he was also a dog breeder. He bred the Hall's Heeler, which became the Blue Heeler, the Australian cattle dog, and is Bluey, basically.
Yeah.
He's Bluey's foundation breeder.
Right.
And so the dogs were bred on Gundabri Station in Merriwa and Dartbrook near Scone. So Dartbrook was the hub of the estate. They went up into the Hunter, crossed the Hunter, and then created Dartbrook Cattle Run. And then it was a halfway point between Sydney and...
So was it eventually recognised by the government of the day, the actual squat?
The squat...
Because that's huge. There must have been other people in...
Oh, like they weren't doing it by themselves. So when I say...
Telling me went from the Hunter to Darling Downs.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the Halls.
It wasn't just the Halls. Right. No,
okay. That's what I was thinking. Yeah, it was just the Halls.
So George, so John Henry Fleming that led
the
Mile Creek Massacre, his oldest brother Joseph was running the show for the Flemings.
Right.
Thomas Simpson Hall was running the show for the Halls.
Yep.
And there was Henry Danger.
Yep.
There was a number of other families. I can't remember all their names.
Yep.
And they tended to get squats together all the way up because they were having to fight for the land. They were squatting on the land, but they were being challenged because the local Aboriginals in each area were having their food sources destroyed and Yeah, so that was, they were right on the face of the frontier wars. Yeah.
Right, yep. Right. So how are the Halls and the Flemings, how did that happen? Was that?
Yeah, so the first daughter, Elizabeth, right, married John Fleming.
Oh, right.
All right, so yeah, the second child, George Smith Hall, he's my third generation great-grandfather. Right. So I'm on the second branch of the George Hall estate family tree.
Right. So,
but the interesting thing, and I only found out this in the last couple of months, and that brings me closer to John Henry Fleming, was that my third generation great uncle married John Henry Fleming's sister, Elizabeth.
Yep.
And his sister, so my second gen great grandmother, she died and left a five-year-old daughter, my direct great-grandmother.
Right, okay. And now we're beginning to understand.
Yeah, and then William Smith Hall and Elizabeth Fleming, married couple, looked after my five-year-old great-grandmother from 5 years of age. So I've started to create digital collages as artworks for myself just to be able to explain the complexity of all this in my own way. And I've created one called, and I'm basing it around the Australian identity, because the Australian identity is quite confused, and I put in brackets after the Australian identity the aspect that I'm describing. So this work's called The Australian Identity, A Juxtaposition of Care, because my great-grandmother was looked after by John Henry Fleming's sister from 5 years of age, and my whole branch of the family tree may not exist without that care, whereas her brother killed 28 women, children and elders in not a, I don't call it a mopping up, I don't call it a genocide or a massacre anymore.
No.
I call that a mopping up exercise, because they were just going through killing them.
That's
all.
That's right, they were trying to exterminate them, exterminate the opposition.
That's right, there was no men there, it wasn't a fight, it was just women, children and elders.
And the details that have come out of that make Dante's Inferno look like a picnic when you actually look at the original documents. So, but people say to you, so what, Peter? I'm sure people are saying that to you. What's it got to do with you, mate?
Yeah, well, for some reason it affects me emotionally. And whether that's my makeup as an advocate, that I care for people. But all that dispossession and all that, I don't know if you call it, it was the worst racism you could imagine at that point
time. That's right.
That is still existing six generations down in some people. And it's stopping self-determination for a lot of Aboriginal people. So because of that story, I went to Mile Creek for the first time in 23.
Right.
And then I got to know the people on the committee. They have the weekend is actually a three-day weekend. They have a yarning at UNE, University of New England in Armidale, and they'll have the guest speaker for that year there. So
And who's the guest speaker for this year?
Well, this year it's an artist that's done some Mile Creek artwork and is part of the original forming committee.
Right. And last year you were going to say, who was last year?
But the last 2 years have been, the first 2 years ago it was Richard Trudgeon. Richard's the Y Warriors. He's written the Y Warriors education program. So the Yolngu up in northeast Arnhem Land commissioned him. He'd worked up there as a civilian tradesman, but got to know the people. He got brought into ceremonial levels until now in his 70s and elder, and they commissioned him to do the White Warriors educational program. So it's black fella learn a bit of white fella, and white fella learn a bit of black fella. And I haven't seen that program anywhere else in Australia. What I've seen, it should be converted in every other language all the nations across Australia. That would be a really good start. And then last year with Bo Spearham, who runs the Frontier Wars podcast.
Right. Yeah. Now, just going back, the actual date was the 10th of June, 1838. So is anything happening this year? And how are you involved?
Okay, so this year's 25th anniversary of the Memorial Weekend.
Yeah.
So it's not run exactly on the date, but it's run on the long weekend, King's Birthday weekend now. So it starts off with the yarning with the guest speaker and other speakers at UNE on the Friday. Saturday is a cultural event it's changed over 1 year. They had the first 23 was a rock concert last year, and this year are an art exhibition at Ceramic Break, which is a farm outside of Bingra.
Mm-hmm.
So the township of Bingra, Mile Creek's about, I'm guessing it's about 11K out of town,
right,
on the Inverell Road. And it's where the township of Bingra, that was a Hall cattle run.
Hmm.
Our Halls Creek runs into the Gwydir River,
right,
at Bingra. Yeah, so that's a cultural event on the...
And can anybody turn up?
Anyone, yep.
So what's the process? Are you going?
Yeah, I'm going. This will be the third year of being.
Right.
And then the Memorial weekend is on the Sunday. The Memorial ceremony is on the Sunday. So it starts with we meet at a shearer's shed that's on site. It's about a 2K walk up to the memorial site, and there's
So the memorial is not on the site of the Stockade Massacre.
No, it's basically it's on the hill. The memorial site's on the hill.
So
the massacre site's down in the gully.
Right.
It's sacred land basically. Right. It's down in the creek.
Okay.
And they've got a granite stone up on the top of the hill.
Mm.
But the process of the day is we have a gathering, basically for a little bit of context of the day, safety talk, all that, down at the shearer's shed on the property adjacent to the memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And then we walk up slowly up to the top of the hill, and there's like a corroboree circle. And the Gamilaroi Academy kids come in and any other guest dancers that may be there. They do they have dances. They have the Welcome mm-hmm. to Country
mm-hmm.
by the elders. Mm-hmm. Annie Sue Blacklock runs that.
So do people know your background? Do they know your background?
So I've after the first year, I went to the AGM that's run in the afternoon after the memorial, because
mm-hmm.
Sandy Tour's quite remote. It gets everybody face to face there. Found out about it. There's a friends group in Armidale, there's a friends group in Sydney. So I said, well, I'm living in Melbourne. We need to educate people more about this shared history of ours. So I decided to create a Melbourne friends group, offered to do that. So they accepted me on the national committee as the coordinator of a Melbourne friends group. And with that authority, I suppose, I've built quite, over the last 2 years now, I've built quite a large network. So I've had a cultural consultation with Wurundjeri here in Melbourne, and with the idea, we've got you're looking up on the web, it's Morley Granger's a Caucasian artist up in Toowoomba, and mm-hmm. she's created a pen and ink history story of the Mile Creek
mm-hmm.
event and the trial and everything. So
I'm interested. I'm sure people can find out the history, but I'm actually interested, and this is a true act of reconciliation, isn't it? You've got the colonised and then descendants. You've got the descendants of the colonised and descendants of the colonised.
Yeah. So the Mile Creek
Yeah,
the Mile Creek Friends, it's Aboriginal-led.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Munro's the lead elder of it at the moment, along with Annie Sue Blacklock.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Aboriginal-led.
Co-convener.
Co-convened. And so they've got co-chaired, that's a term,
Co-chaired, yeah.
Yeah, so Anne Daly's the Caucasian co-chair.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's various committee members.
Right.
So I, through being on the committee, I found out about this cradled exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to create, the proposal is to create a Mile Creek exhibition in Melbourne as an opportunity and bring in associated things in Melbourne.
Right, right. So if people are interested, is there any websites they can go to?
There's the friendsofmilecreek.com.
Mm-hmm.
You see that for the background on the memorial weekend. What I'm doing at this stage, it's just my Facebook site.
Which is what?
Which is Peter Stevenson.
What, you're the only Peter Stevenson in the world?
Well,
Facebook.
It's got the banner page is it's got me embracing Keith Munro.
Oh, right. Because
part of the ceremony, it's a reconciliation ceremony. So they get the relations of the perpetrators, the relations of the descendants,
and
we all come together and we embrace and light candles.
Right.
And
well, considering Reconciliation Week starts on the 27th of May, National Sorrow Day, and ends on Mabo Day, the 3rd of June, the fact that it's a week later. And in the last minute, you're doing a long walk or something, you tell me.
So this year, I've done a reconciliation trial the last 2 years. This will be the third year to finish that George Hall Estate.
Right.
I'm doing the Surat to Bingra leg this year through Moree.
Yes.
But of course, I put a submission in with the Europe Justice Commission. It's part of the truth-telling in Victoria. That's whereas Queensland, they've cancelled the truth-telling with the Liberal state government.
Yeah.
But we've actually got it together in Victoria. So they're walking that report, truth-telling report, to Parliament from the original settlement at Port Hedland, Portland. Mm. And so I'm going to do the first leg of that, then go up to Mile Creek, do the a week to finish off the trail.
Right.
And then finish off the walk to Parliament.
Right. All strength to you, Peter. We need more colonial truth tellers. What are you trying to tell me, Daryl? 30 seconds.
30 seconds, yeah.
Oh, God, Daryl.
15
now. Look, Peter, thanks very much for coming to the studio. All power to you. I hope your projects come to fruition. And it's good to meet somebody who's actually not in front of the TV or going down a rabbit hole, you know, on the net when they retire. So congratulations to you, your family, and all you're doing, and all strength to you, and all the best for the reconciliation process. It's an important period in Australian history, and the failure of the Voice is just one more step. That's all it is, just another step.
It's been part of the process.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Daryl. And
you're welcome.
I'll see you next week, Daryl.
Okay. You have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guest Peter Stevenson. And don't forget, Wednesday the 11th of June will be our Radiothon show, so be sure to tune in along with your wallet, ready to donate your money so we can keep on going, because it's your station, your voice.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.